Saving and everything for your next project now at Menards. Breathe easier with Vestair Ultimate Allergen Air Filters. They trap large airborne particles to keep allergens out of your home, and they last up to 90 days. Save big on all Vestair products at Menards and refresh your home today. View our selection of air filtration products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find great deals happening now. Save big.
Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
And Kate.
Welcome to MedCrimes.
Welcome to July. The end of July already.
I was going to say, we've been in July, first of
all. I know. It's like...
How about welcome to the pod lab? Because...
There's that.
It's been a few weeks.
It's been more than a minute.
Yeah. Our last few episodes were remote, so I missed you.
I missed the crap out of you. It's been weird,
it's
but...
It's nice to see your whole instead of...
My
nice
whole?
To see all of you.
Seven.
Wow. The whole person. It's nice to see your whole being.
Thank you. Yes. It is lovely to see yours as well. And it's been lovely doing remote, but it's just most lovely when you're here. And I think it just sounds better, genuinely.
Oh, duh.
A couple people online said that our last episode sounded like we were on helium.
A tin can.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That or on helium. I heard that a couple times.
Really?
And I was like, I don't know what to make of that because... To me, it sounded like we did our normal thing.
Do they sound like that?
I was like, well, we didn't change anything, but I love the idea. Maybe
well,
next time.
2 weeks from now, we'll be post-birthday party, so maybe we'll suck on the helium and
see,
give it a try.
There you
go. We'll compare notes.
Yeah, we are going to have a fabulous part two of Buck Ruxton, but first, Patreons.
Patreons.
Again, I'm going to say this again. We've said this, I think, more than once. We know that the correct term is patron.
Oh,
we
come
know
on,
that.
People.
We do know that. I get messages probably almost every day
Guys,
correcting
at
me.
At this point, it's
just
for
a
fun.
Thing. It's just a thing that we do because it's just a word. It's just a thing. So
patrons
I'm sorry if it
does not sound as fun as Patreon.
I know that's just a thing that we're doing, and I'm sorry if the thing is bothersome. But
get over yourself.
Also, we love you.
That's
and thank you for
I'm
listening.
In. That's the mood I'm in.
So, anyway, our Patreon / patrons are Sarah Yeary. Hi, Sarah. Welcome.
Hey, hey.
Woo! Beth Sherry. Hi, Beth.
Hello, Beth.
And Formula Crumb.
Wow.
I love that.
Kind of formula.
I don't know, but thank you all. We so
the
appreciate
best
you guys.
Patron name.
It might be.
We've got.
It's amazing. We've gotten a couple of cool ones. That
I
one
that.
Is up there on the list.
So what are our patrons?
Our patrons are the Slide Rock Bolter. Have you heard of this? Because
no.
I did not.
Did you make this up?
No, I swear to God I didn't. It sounds made up because it probably is. And it's from American folklore. And it is a whale-like creature that has a tail that has like grappling spikes and like hooks on it. It literally is the size of a whale. And apparently it just slides down mountain faces to crush hikers.
Done. Like,
I don't know the thing's motivations.
I could have run into those yesterday when I was doing a hike.
So
thank you for not crushing me.
Thank you
me,
for not. Yeah. So anyway, thank the three of you for not crushing Devin while she was
yeah,
hiking.
I would not be here today.
Yeah. So the Slide Rock Bolter, that's what you guys are.
Hey, hey.
Woohoo! So I was...
Can I just say I'm amazed that we still have mythical creatures 5 years later?
I think that it's... So, yes, I love that I love that we are still doing this, and I think the people love it because if we... I've had messages of people who were, like, with us very, very early on, like, before we started doing the mythical creature
right, right,
thing.
Right. And they wanted to be a
and
creature.
And they're like, I know I've been a patron for a long time, and I know we weren't doing it back then, but could I have a creature? And, like, those couple of times I've just reannounced them and
yes.
given them a creature. And it's just another thing, okay? It's just another one of our MedCrimes things that
for
we
being
love,
a Patreon.
We enjoy.
When you're a Patreon.
We are just.
We do what you want.
We are bringing joy. Also, we were talking about doing another Patreon special coming up. So Patreon / patrons. Stay tuned, baby.
Stay tuned.
We're going to do it. So we have part two of Dr. Buck Ruxton today. And I was saying before we did the first part that what is really fascinating about this specific case is the forensics. And in the year 1935, think about the resources that we had and the very fundamental scientific resources that we had. It was really nothing that was
slim
anywhere close to what we have today, right? So the police work and the forensics and just the boots on the ground and the science behind how they convict this guy is just so fascinating. And it was really, it set a precedent for investigations and, you know, forensics in general. It really is one of those noteworthy cases that like stands the test of time. So it's just interesting to kind of look at how that all was done. So we're gonna take a break. So without further ado. Now, on Sunday, September 15th at 6:30 in the morning, Dr. Buck Ruxton left his house in a rush because the night before he had murdered his wife and his family's live-in maid slash nurse. Her name is Mary Rogerson. She had been with them since they had their second child, had been living in the house with them, doing like housework for them and helping her. Helping Buck's wife sort of like rear their children. Basically, she helped raise the kids. So she was basically a member of the family. And go listen back to part one, but just to kind of summarize, this was a very toxic relationship between Buck, a physician who was born in India, later came to London and then the surrounding area to practice medicine, where he met his wife. And the two hit it off, but it just became a very toxic and abusive relationship.
Very much so.
As his wife, Isabella, started reaching out to help, you know, to her sister and to the police and to friends, it kind of just fell on deaf ears. And despite all of the recourse that everybody around her witnessed and was part of, she was... unfortunately, you know, a victim of this man for years, a victim of his abuse. And then it escalated to this point in which she ended up getting killed by him.
Which is awful.
So trigger warnings are going to include, again, domestic violence. We talked more about that in the first part, so we're not going to be as heavily into that this time around. But there will be some references to it. We are going to talk about some of the things that he did to the bodies and why he earned the moniker of the Jigsaw Killer and why these were the Jigsaw Murders. Ooh. So there's going to be a little bit of graphic detail here and there. I'm going to sort of skim over what I can. I'm going to share what is necessary to be descriptive and to tell their story, but I won't get too gratuitous with it. I just wanted to make you guys kind of aware of the stuff that is coming up. So... now, Sunday, September 15th, after Buck had murdered those two women in his house, he actually did not have a ton of time before people like really started sort of asking questions. And for him, his first order of business was heading to his cleaning lady's house because he knew that his cleaning lady was actually due to show up at their house. And he was like, what I don't want is for her to walk in when I have not even cleaned up the crime scene. And the crime scene was very graphic. His cleaning lady's name was Agnes Oxley. So he actually headed first to her house. And what he found when he knocked on the door was actually her husband answered the door. And Buck informed her husband that Agnes is not needed to work at the house today. I'm actually doing some remodeling and Mrs. Ruxton, my wife, and our maid, Mary Rogerson, are actually away for a vacation along with the kids. So it's just me in the house. I'm doing some projects, so you don't need to show up.
So please...
please don't come over
to my crime scene.
And the reason why he didn't want her in there is because he had a lot to do. Because the murder took place on an upstairs landing. So they had this like sort of open staircase in their home. And then they had this landing, that sort of oversaw like the entryway. And that's in theory where a lot of the violence and the crime took place because that was like soaked in blood. It was like all in the carpets. It was all over the walls. It was on the ceiling. It was everywhere. So he knew that he had to act really quickly because even though he said that Mary and Isabella were away on vacation, obviously they're not. They're dead. And number two, his kids were actually asleep in the house. They were all in the house asleep during all of this.
And how old were they at the time?
So it was, let's see, this is 1935. They had their first child, I think, in 1926, I said. So one of them
is... So, first of all, and my mind just goes to, so, but he's a murderer. So, like,
for sure.
Of course he would just be fine with leaving the house and walking to the housekeeper's house and while the kids are
first
sleeping,
thing in the morning.
Like, leaving him alone. And what did he not think, what if a child wakes up and sees what I've done?
He is also an idiot.
These are the things that my normal brain thinks of.
No, I mean, that's the first place mine went to. Like, what
you
if the kids had just,
alone?
Like, woken
and
up
first
to
of
find...
All, you left him alone. Second of all, you left him alone where there's a murder scene.
Everywhere. He's an idiot. It was a different time, right? They had a little over 10-year-old kid in the house. Maybe he was like, you know, they're old enough to... and like, he was just really banking on, I really hope they don't wake up, and just like took a risk because he felt like he had to in that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm guessing that was where it came from.
I get it.
And so Buck then proceeded
to
take...
I just have to point out areas of his stupidity.
Oh, I know. I'd love to... hey, if you see anything else, feel free to interrupt me and let's shine a light on all of his stupid moments,
let's
please. Because he's the worst. So... Buck, while the kids were still sleeping, again, this is all first thing in the morning, he gets back home, and he gets a bunch of towels. He starts soaking everything up. He starts cutting out the carpet where everything is bloody. He took his clothes, and a couple of other items that were all like beyond repair and just soaked in blood. And he brought them out to the backyard and he soaked them with gasoline. And he attempted to burn them, but unfortunately, it was actually raining like all night, and it was still raining. I know, it's so sad that nothing would like light and burn beyond recognition. Mm-hmm. You could still clearly see what everything was. So at that point, he decided to just like hatch this new plan. But while he was trying to figure out what to do next, there was a knock on his door.
Where were the bodies at this point?
So the bodies were still in the bedroom
bathroom.
He
hasn't done anything with them yet.
The exact location of the bodies at this second is not really known, because all we know is like what the crime scene indicates and he finally admitted to, which was not much at the end of the day. So he hears this knock at the door. So he doesn't want to like rouse suspicion by not answering or risk having someone just like walk in. So he goes in and he finds that their paper deliverer, whose name was Winifred Roberts, was standing outside. And Winifred was surprised to see Buck because he always interacted with either Mary or his wife Isabella. And sometimes she would interact with Agnes, who was their cleaning lady, who was always there every Saturday morning. Exactly. So, but never him. She's like, that's weird that he's here. And he gave her a similar story, saying that his wife and Mary had left on a vacation. So he was there watching over the house. Winifred just said, okay, here's your newspapers and I'm going to go. And she goes on her way. Buck goes back to work trying to clean things up. He gets another knock on the door, and it was just like an hour later, and it's the milk delivery girl. Her name is Margaret Hinson, and she said she had a similar interaction. Oh, you're here. You know, I expect to see Agnes or Isabella or Mary. And he gave her the same thing. Same story. The two are away on vacation. And so this is now like three people that he's interacted with that morning that he's given this story to and that are witnessing him kind of disheveled, answering the door.
And like, it's out of the norm.
And it's out of the norm, like very out of routine for all of them. His big mistake through all of this was informing these women that he interacted with that Isabella and Mary had taken the kids. This was kind of like a lazy thing for him, like to try to, you know, remove the kids from the crime scene. But it's something that was very quickly refuted, and the police later used it to be like immediately that he's lying, because we know that
someone,
the kids were in the house.
Because someone saw the kids.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Like, yep. So this is just an important detail, because eventually the police do use it to kind of turn things on him. So Margaret, the milk lady, came inside. She left the milk just like sitting on the table in the hall where she always does. And then she headed back to the street. And then after that, another lady shows up saying that her son had an operation that was scheduled for that morning with Buck because, you know, they had their medical practice sort of on their property. Mm-hmm. So she shows up and she's like, hey, we're here for like the surgery that was planned for weeks. I'm not actually sure what the procedure was, but he did have a surgical room attached to the house where he completed procedures. And of course, if Buck had like totally dropped the ball and kind of forgotten that he scheduled this and like panicked and he was like, listen, it's really not a good day. I'm not feeling well. I've got some personal stuff going on. We need to reschedule. So he kind of fibbed her with that. And she was like disappointed, but she rescheduled with him and then she left with her son. And by this time, Buck is like flustered. He's frustrated. He cannot do anything without being interrupted. And he's just trying to keep people out of the house. And he decided that, you know, it would be best that the children didn't hear him lying about where his mom and Mary are. So just before 11:30 a.m., he actually grabbed the kids and he drove them to the Anderson residence, which is where his friends Herbert and Ethel lived. And he asked, hey, will you guys please watch my kids for like a day or two? I just have some renovations in the house. Isabel and Mary are away. I really need them to just like not be in the house. And they were like, I mean, of course. Yeah, that's fine. Ethel asked Buck, though, about what happened to his hand because she noticed that he had a bandage on his hand that was like soaked in blood. Like he had really injured his hand, right? And Buck said, oh, you know, I was cutting open a can of peaches earlier and that just the can opener, just, you know, those old like handle mm-hmm. ones just went right through my hand and it hurt real bad. So in all likelihood, that is obviously not what happened. We'll talk a little bit more about where we think he injured his hand. Buck then returns to his car and he drives back home finally without the kids in the house. And he is alone in the house. The bodies are still in the house, and it is at this point that it is believed that he started to sort of process the corpses into a more easily disposable form. And the first thing he did was drain the corpses of their remaining blood. Ooh. This is where things do start get a little on the graphic side, just as an FYI.
All right. Brace myself.
I know. So it was actually later found that there was a dark red discoloration in the bottom of their tub. So it's believed that he, one after the other, put the bodies in the tub and drained their blood and then began to dismember the bodies by disarticulating them at all of the joints, like at the knee joints, the hip joints, took the heads off. And so he did this because, obviously, number one, it would be easier for him to piece them out and carry them, which is awful to say, like into his vehicle and be able to manage all of that on his own. And number two, to hopefully destroy any evidence and any ability to identify them down the road. This is like sort of what he's thinking. This is no simple task. I'm just saying to be physically very strong to do this on your own and very skilled in anatomy, which we know he is. He's a physician.
Right. But yeah, this, you're right. The strength in general. What did he use it?
So there are many surgical tools that would do this job very well. But even with all of those employed, disarticulating and dismembering a body would have probably taken him upwards of 3 to 5 hours. This is a huge, physically involved
a lot of strength
process. Mm-hmm. A lot of strength. And I just am trying to wrap my head around like the state of mind one has to be in. You know what I mean? To like look at yourself in the moment, covered in your wife's blood, and just say, for 5 straight hours, I am just dismembering my wife in this tub.
And doing it for 2 people.
And do it for 2 people. And then dispose of everything the way he did, which we'll talk about too. But it's just how does one get to this point?
I don't know.
You know?
There's a lot of things that happen that just I try to make a connection. I like reason.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
It's wild. It's wild. So we're not sure exactly how long it took, but we can guesstimate. And Buck made stupid errors, but he also was somewhat of an intelligent man. So he knew that if he dumped these bodies even anywhere remotely close to him, it would be very much, it would be a lot easier for them to identify who they were and maybe even trace them back to him. So he felt like the best chance he had to get away with the murders was to scatter these body parts in a much harder to find area. So Buck had dismembered these corpses, right? We are surmising that he probably cut his hand doing that because he was wielding very sharp instruments to do that in theory. And
so we don't think that happened during the murder.
No,
like
we think
it
may have been, or it might have been when he was dismembering the bodies. Either one is equally plausible. So after he had managed to do that, his house was still, even with the carpets gone and the blood's, you know, the blood like somewhat cleaned up, everything was just horribly in disarray. And it was still very obviously like a murder scene. So and then even worse with Buck's injury, with his hand being cut, he was it was actually cut so bad that there was a lot that he could not do on his own. Like he literally couldn't use his hand. So some people have
sawed himself.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. Well, what they think happened is that he may have like even severed one of his tendons in his hand, like so that he couldn't really work his fingers very well.
Ouch.
So he decided to enlist the help of two unsuspecting friends. And
no shit.
At some point between the murders and the cleanup, he called his longtime working class patient, Mary Hampshire, and her husband, who also had become somewhat of family friends with with them. And he had said to them, well, you know, my wife and my maid are both on a trip. My kids are out of the house. And I just, you know, I cut my hand opening that darn tin of peaches and I just cannot do all of this lifting and stuff by myself. And they believed Buck when Buck said that, you know, he had wounded himself with a tin of peaches and that the blood on the carpet is from just his work as a physician and the procedures that he conducts within his home, and that all of this is very reasonable. They really had no, you know, reason initially to not believe him. He was a very trusted member of the community. And Buck also offered to pay them for helping him get all cleaned up, and they did. And they removed a lot more carpet. They started mopping up more of the blood that Buck didn't get. They cleaned things. And Mary actually felt sorry for Buck because she, you know, they had a really good relationship. And he also was her personal physician. And she felt like she knew him well enough to know that, oh, I feel bad for this guy. You know, he just needs help. So Buck had even said, hey, if you want anything in the house, you can just take it. Like any belongings, like that nice vase, you can have that. Which was kind of weird. Like what? And she's like, okay, you invited me over to help you clean. Like
now you're just giving.
Why are you
away.
Offering me family heirlooms?
Right.
What are you planning to do, sir? What is going on? So that was a little weird. Although there were some clothing items of his wife's that he also offered her, which is stuff that Mary could probably never really afford on her own, and she actually accepted a couple of them. She was very appreciative of his kind donation. And once they had helped clean and get some things out of the house, Buck then got back to work in the other phase of his plan. So again, we have no precise timeline because it was never confirmed. But an extensive investigation produced sort of an approximation of what unfolded next. So they think that he transported the bodies, or what was left of them, 2 days after the murder. So he kept the bodies in his house for 2 days, is what is surmised. And on Tuesday, September 17th, Buck then drove the dismembered body parts of his wife and his live-in nurse to Garden Homelin. And this is a long drive away. It's several hours by car. So no, his thought was like, if these remains are found, no one is going to suspect that these are from Lancaster, which is where he and Isabel lived. So his thought is like, the further I get away, the better, because this like just disconnects me entire thing. Right. So he arrives at this ravine with like a river on the bottom, and So he arrived there, he gets out of his car, and he's got these bags full of like individually wrapped body parts, basically. And he is believed to have emptied these bags over the side of the bridge and just let them float down the river. And
which is going to destroy the tissue and all of that.
Yes, exactly.
So, making it even more harder to identify.
That's exactly what he was hoping for, right? On his return journey home, fun fact, you're going to hate him even more in a second. Fun fact, his return journey home, he casually hit a biker with his car.
Huh?
Yeah. That's all I have on that.
I was going to say, did he stop and apologize?
I have no idea.
Did he say, I'm sorry?
That's all I have.
Over and put him in the ravine? I don't.
But this is how unhinged this man is, that he's just like so disconnected from reality and like so distracted and, you know, out of his mind in this state that he just is hitting cyclists, you know?
Sorry, cyclist.
So it seems also that Buck may have made two trips to dump the bodies, which is interesting because in theory, if he had been able to get everything in his car, which he should have, it should have only taken him one trip. But we're not sure if maybe he did that just to break up the flow of the body parts. But it's believed that he dumped them in the same place, just making two separate trips that were days apart.
Okay.
Which is interesting. So... and it's thought this because his housekeeper, Agnes Oxley, observed Buck loading things from his room to his car. And then after he left, Agnes visited the second floor and noticed a really unpleasant smell in Buck's room.
So she didn't listen to the whole don't come by, I'm renovating.
This was the 19th. So this was 2 days after he had said don't come.
But he said don't come, I'm renovating. Like for me, that's like, sweet, I got a week. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I know. I don't know that he gave her a timeline. But she did come back on the 19th. So, and she noticed that he was loading his car with stuff. And she's like, boy, does it stink in here. But she, at the time, you know, didn't know what it was. You know?
Like.
And then she noticed him doing the same thing days later when she was there. Mm. So she noticed like multiple times he was loading things into the back of his car. And in the following weeks, it became apparent that Buck was trying to cover his tracks, spread it around that his wife was missing, that she was having an affair, that she might have run off with someone, and playing the role of like the aggrieved husband, basically.
Mm-hmm. She was supposed to go on vacation.
Exactly. Never came back. And on September 24th, he actually went to the police station and demanded that they find his wife. She said, she's left me. She's with Robert Edmondson, which remember from the first part, she's the family friend that she went on a trip with. Mm-hmm. And he just threw Robert right under the bus, who has nothing to do with anything other than just like along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And then on September 26th, he ended up writing a letter to his sister-in-law, Jeannie, who was very, very close to Isabel. And he wrote a letter stating Isabella had left me and then that she had been gambling, that she had a lot of debts, that she was cheating on him, that she was having all these affairs.
In part one, we discuss how the sister was kind of in the know of some of the domestic issues.
She was very aware.
So she was probably like, nah, I don't believe this shit.
She actually almost immediately did not believe him, which is great. Because she was like done with all this BS because she had witnessed all of this stuff go down.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, he claimed that Isabella was helping Mary Rogerson because the housemaid, Mary, had apparently found herself in a quote-unquote certain condition. So this is what he's telling Jeannie, that Isabella and Mary are actually both away because Mary has found herself to be unmarried and pregnant, and my wife is helping her navigate an abortion, basically, is what he is implying. Totally made up. He had totally found that, you know, totally made that up. So he's expressing these theories about where his wife is, but Jeannie was like, I am not convinced by any of this. She was like, I had told myself that if anything ever happened to my sister or if she went up missing, I would know exactly what happened.
That it was all on him.
That it's all on
Correct.
Him.
Yeah.
So she immediately has this sinking feeling like, holy
Which
fuck.
Which is all wise. Like anyone who feels threatened, you should find a point person.
Listen
and be like, hey.
To your gut.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And have somebody in your corner who will be like, I know that something is not right.
Yes.
I know it's not right.
If I somehow just pop up missing, this has been going on.
Yep, exactly. So she knew that Buck being all erratic and sending these crazy, weird, somewhat subtly threatening letters was like his way of just trying to backtrack. And she's like, I am not convinced by any of this. She actually confronted that suspicion by, and so like instead of like feeding into the lies, she just like sent him a letter saying, you are not welcome to come to my home. Like, I don't know where my sister is. I hope she's okay. She is not here, but you are not welcome in my home. Like, just forewarning him, you best not fucking show up on my doorstep, sir. On Sunday, September 29th, Susan Hayes Johnson walked along the country road in the small Scottish town of Moffat. And she was actually on a vacation with her brother at the time. And they both lived in Edinburgh. And she thought that, you know, a vacation would be good for our mental health and, you know, maybe let us clear our heads. And after some time, she reached Garden Homeland, which is like this little like sort of subset of that area. And there's like this beautiful stone bridge and there was like a shallow ravine underneath of it. And she stood and she was like kind of admiring, you know, the wilderness. And she noticed something out of place. On the stream bank, she saw what looked to be a human body part. So she immediately panics and she rushed back to find her brother. And she told her brother what she saw. And together they both went back and looked. And Alfred, her brother, actually like was able to navigate down into the ravine to get a better look. He's like, what if this is like a doll part or something? We don't know. So he gets back down onto the stream bank and he finds what looks like a human arm protruding from newspaper and old sheet that was wrapped around like the bottom of it. It was an incredibly gruesome, shocking discovery. And the residents of the town, like, this was not something that just routinely washed up in stream banks in this area. This is a peaceful farming community, very picturesque.
When I go to Scotland in 2028, I will find this ravine and I will get a picture of it all.
Thank you. Yes. This is here it is. Here it is. Yep. And so the days following, the police department started scouring the area. And the police department, honestly, like the Moffat police, were probably not very well equipped to handle this. But holy shit, did they handle this well. It is shocking. Like, it is shocking how well they did with the limited resources and experience that they had with stuff like this. They started recovering more and more body parts the more they looked. So they discovered 2 heads, 3 femurs. 2 forearms with attached hands, 2 upper arms, a woman's chest and torso, 2 legs, a 3rd forearm with a hand attached, a pelvis, and nearly 30 separate portions of human flesh. And these were all separately bundled with things like sheet, pillowcases, straw, newspaper, cotton, and even a pair of child's clothing and
Can
women's clothing.
Imagine being the first responders and the investigators upon that and having to just open this and what you find.
That sounds like one of those moments that just stays with you and it's like surreal. It's like this isn't real.
You're
this
never
is fake.
Gonna get out of your head.
No. This is one of those things that breaks people. You know what I mean? Like I feel like people in law enforcement, I have so much respect. Holy shit, so much respect for you. Guys, the stuff that you see on a daily basis is outrageous. But yes, this is a lot. This is so much. So they discovered all of this. And a month later, October 28th, 1935, a road worker then found a newspaper bundle containing a left foot in the Edinburgh-Carlisle Road, which was 9 miles south of Moffat. So it kind of drifted all of 9 miles all the way down to find that spot.
In what span of time?
This was October 28th, so it was like 3 weeks. Yeah, just under a month. And then on November 4th, a woman found a 4th forearm and hand lying in the grass by the roadside, 0.5 mile south of Garden Homeland. And so this is in total over the course of 5 weeks, 70 pieces of human body parts and tissue were recovered.
70? Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh.
So we're beginning to see why this is called the Jigsaw Murders.
Because it's a puzzle.
Because they're literally, they were sawed apart, ugh, which is so sad. These findings were all transported to the University of Edinburgh for preservation and reconstruction. And if you recall, when we talked about, I think it was Burke and Hare, Edinburgh.
God, I haven't thought of them in a long time. I know. Right?
Edinburgh was one of the birthplaces of anatomy and medicine in this time period. And like in the late 1800s, mm-hmm, early 1900s, they were like on the forefront. So it was actually sort of fortuitous, probably, that all of this happened in this area, because I don't know that the crime would have been solved without these brains looking at all of this.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? So they got everything over to the University of Edinburgh, and they were able to preserve things as best they could, and they started reconstructing the bodies. Obviously, number one step is trying to figure out who these people are, because mm-hmm. if we're ever going to solve this, we got to mm-hmm. identify these four people. So, unfortunately, the heads, which they would normally use to identify people, had been mutilated beyond recognition. So this is going to get graphic, but
and dental records was not a thing.
We're going to get to that. They were a thing. We're going to get to that.
Oh God.
So
I'm putting my head down.
I know. So, the ears, the eyes, the lips, the noses, and almost all of the facial skin had actually been removed. Also, Buck had gone ahead and removed all of the teeth because of dental records. And this was very disheartening to investigators, because one of the first steps they were going to take was going to be looking at dental records. Mm-hmm. And the anatomical team heading this case at Edinburgh was actually run by a Professor James Brash. And he had two dental experts who worked with him to identify the remaining teeth. There were a few teeth that were left. And forensic dentistry had actually been in use well before 1935, actually like a couple of centuries even.
Okay.
People had been going and looking at dental records to identify
bodies. I
wasn't sure, like,
how old it was.
Yeah, it's a pretty old science, actually. Mm. And there's a number of ways in which teeth can be used to identify a victim's gender, their age, their identity. So it's not just like you have to have the exact arch that so-and-so has mm-hmm. to identify who it is. Like, you can, even if you can't identify the exact person, there's a lot of information you can garner just from a few teeth. So one of the ways is the way that we all know, which is like to compare their actual teeth that you find to their pre-mortem dental records, which obviously wasn't really going to be possible with a lot of the teeth having been mm-hmm. removed. They were able, forensic dentists are also able to identify and analyze and compare bite mark impressions to implicate victims and assailants under, like, of assault. If, like, someone has a bite mark on them from an assault, they can actually, like,
match that up,
which is interesting. So, unfortunately, again, there's not many teeth left, so they have very little to work with. But it led to the anatomical team to sort of adopt the theory that whoever had done this had very significant medical and anatomical knowledge, or at the very least, a knowledge of forensics and crime solving, because he wouldn't have been able to really wrap his head around that if he was just some schmo. You know what I mean? Like, it's
not knowing what to remove.
It's impressive that he took that step. It was very impressive to investigators that he did that. So that wasn't what they had hoped to find, but it was a lead. So meanwhile, while the body parts are in Edinburgh, the Moffat police had launched their own investigation, and they have boots on the ground. They're starting to canvass the neighborhood. And like the forensics team, they are collaborating with three other Scottish forces, the Dumfrieshire Constabulary, the Glasgow Police Force, and the City of Edinburgh Police Force, each of which all contributed to this crime, like in solving this crime. So their first clue was obviously the remains being found in majority in one singular area. So they're like, this had to have been where he dumped the bodies, because they wouldn't all necessarily float at the same rate and stop in the same spot. So they think that the parcels had been thrown over that same bridge that that huge dump site was found, most likely at night, most likely by somebody pretty familiar with that town, but not with the behavior of this particular stream. Because if they had been from the area, they would have known that the stream had actually recently flooded. And the locals all agreed that on the 17th and 18th of September, that stream had run very high and fast, explaining why several body parts were found so far south of all of this. And this piece of information had started to give people like a timeline. So the bodies were most
intriguing.
So the bodies were this told investigators they were most likely disposed of on the 16th, 17th, or 18th because they would have. If it flooded on the 17th and 18th of September, then that would make the most sense of why they were so found where they were. So, and then they started looking at the wrappings, like the of the body parts. And like I had said, they were found in newspaper. There was clothing, like women's clothing, children's clothing was used to wrap some of them. And they start looking at the papers themselves and noticed that none of them were dated later than September 15th, which further confirmed that timeline of it happening at that point.
Mm-hmm.
There was another clue in the newspapers. One of the newspapers came from the Sunday Graphic with the serial number 1067. And it was just one of only 3,700 copies of a special edition about a carnival that was being held that Saturday. And it had been issued exclusively to a handful of suppliers in Morecambe, Lancaster, and the surrounding areas.
And so that helped them hone in on like where they were going.
Yes, they realized, oh my God, this guy, we don't even think he's even from Scotland. He was from over 100 miles south where the news agents had distributed that single paper. So the next task was, okay, now that we have a potential timeline and a potential area, we have to now look and see if there are missing person reports that match the description of these two people, because they still don't know who these ladies are.
Right.
So they decide to focus on double disappearances. And on October 9th, 10 days after the bodies were discovered, Chief Constable of Dumfries saw an article in the Glasgow Daily Record about the disappearance of a young Lancaster woman named Mary Jane Rogerson, who was the nanny for children of Dr. and Mrs. Buck Ruxton in Lancaster. And the Chief Constable called the Lancaster police, and they confirmed that, yes, Mary is indeed missing. And she was reported missing sooner than Isabella because she had a family. You know, she had other people outside the house.
They knew she wasn't on vacation.
They knew she wasn't on vacation.
Right.
So the cops actually initially visited Mary's family and actually presented them with some of the clothing that had been found, like, wrapped around the remains. And Mary's stepmother immediately was like, that's Mary's blouse.
Oh, shit.
And she knew that because she had given her stepdaughter that blouse after completing. And it's interesting. So she actually recognized it because there was a hole in one of like the underarm areas that she personally had repaired for Mary. Like she had sewn up a hole and she looked in the armpit and she was like, oh, shit, there's that spot that I repaired. This is exactly her specific blouse. So That was awful to find out that way.
Oh, my heart's racing.
A woman named Edith Holm, with whom Isabella Ruxton and the children had stayed that summer, recognized one of the kids' clothes that was found around some of these body parts because she had bought them for her own children and then later gave them to Mary Rogerson as, like, donated them because her kids had grown out of them. And she knew that it was that romper because she personally had fixed one of the elastic waistbands and put a new bow on it. And she's like, that's...
What a long shot.
That's... I know, wow. Right? Isn't it incredible? So, I mean... What a long shot. That's crazy how this worked out. So...
I'm curious if they hit, like, obviously, yes, they looked into her disappearance, but I wonder how many disappearances or missing people they looked into before they got them.
Yes.
I can't imagine it was the first one.
I can't imagine it was the first either. I'm sure they've met some dead ends, but
wow.
Just the timeline. This is October 10th and 12th.
Right.
This had this, and they have figured out who these nameless, faceless women are who were found 100 miles away.
Right.
It's crazy that they were able to figure this out.
Yeah.
With what little they had.
Right. We're talking 90 years ago.
Yes. And knowing where, I mean, all they had to do was ask her family where, you know, what did Mary Rogerson do for work? And they say, oh, well, she's the live-in nanny nurse for Dr. and Mrs. Buck Ruxton. And as they started asking around, they realized nobody's seen Isabella all fucking month.
Right.
Oh, shit.
Right.
So at this point.
Jeez.
The Edinburgh detectives knew that the rest of the investigation was not going to be done in Moffat, where the body parts had been found, but they needed to focus a lot more of the resources in Lancaster because that's where the prime suspect lived, who was looking to be Dr. Buck Ruxton. So they start handing over the case to the Lancaster Borough Police, and they start uncovering just more and more and more on Buck. So in order to build a case, the Lancaster police had to confirm the identity of the bodies. And so all the body parts, again, are at the University of Edinburgh, and the team is working on trying to get forensic evidence that these ladies are who we think that they are at this point. So they're determining the gender, the approximate height and weight, and the approximate age of the two bodies. And the data right now is lining up with the possibility that it is Isabella Ruxton and Mary Rogerson. But the natural decay and the fact that they were in water for a couple of weeks heavily degraded the soft tissue, unfortunately, which we knew was going to happen. And that was the whole reason Buck dumped them like that.
Right.
So it was a really difficult task that they had ahead of them. But for the prosecution to have a good case, the evidence had to be really airtight, especially to take down a guy like Buck, who was a pretty powerful member of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so Professor James Brash, who was leading the forensics team on that case, had a new idea. He arranged to have two photographs of both the missing women delivered to Edinburgh. And he then had the clean skulls photographed in positions matching the positions of the women's heads in the photographs. And the principal features of the photographs were traced on a transparent, like, tracing paper. And then they superimposed those images of the skulls, and the match was astoundingly perfect. Isn't this crazy?
The days before computers.
Yes.
And they're able to do that.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Because they didn't have DNA.
I'm impressed.
But skulls, as it turns out, are like fingerprints. They do show genetic variations. There are very, very clear bone differences that are genetic, and they do relate to a person's living physical appearance heavily. So all of these points, they were able to very specifically match up to Mary and to Isabella.
Wow.
Their skulls were a perfect match. It's like a fingerprint.
Wow.
If you look at the shape, the distance between the eyes, the orbital cavities, the jawline, the nasal bridge, all of that is very person specific, which I actually didn't really realize.
I'm impressed. I didn't either.
And it's sort of like a science that I guess they don't really need much anymore because we have all this other stuff like DNA and cameras and everything else. But it's just crazy how they looked at things back then, because
it all started somewhere.
Sure did.
Wow.
So I just thought that was really fascinating.
No, that is for sure.
So there are a lot of consistencies between Isabella, Mary, and then the skulls, obviously. Now, one of the final tasks was to determine the approximate date of death of the bodies, because that, again, is going to add to our timeline and help, you know, tighten up that case. And Dr. Alexander Mayans is a forensic entomologist from the University of Edinburgh who investigated the bug larvae that was found on the body parts. Mm. And he determined that the larvae were those of the Calophara vicinia, which is the common blowfly. Very common to that area. And it was very unlikely that the eggs had been laid more than 1 or 2 days after the body had been thrown over the bridge. That's like just sort of a general rule when it comes to botfly behavior and like the necrosis of the body and like when it would attract insect activity. So He found that it was more than likely that the bodies had been left in the ravine 12 to 14 days earlier that they had been found. So this timeline corroborated the other timelines, and it was like, that's it. That's more physical evidence that places that date, that specific date.
The who, what, where, when.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we now knew that the bodies had been thrown into the ravine irrefutably between the 16th and 19th of September. And we have a lot of evidence to support that. Back in Lancaster, there is an ongoing police presence of like all around Buck Ruxton. And now they are starting to search his property. And so they revealed more
Check
blood.
Out those renovations.
All the renovations. They start talking to staff in the house. They start investigating and talking with all of those people that had shown up at his doorstep that morning, and how odd he was acting, how disheveled he looked. And they started talking with the Hampshire, who had helped haul bloody carpet and bloody clothes out of his place. Like, this was all looking a little too perfect. Like, this is almost too easy at this point now that we have found this guy. So Buck's reaction to the investigation was that he was protesting the entire way. He was whining that everything was damaging his reputation. Exactly. That's exactly how he sounded. I have it on good authority. And that my medical practice is going to be impacted, and you just don't want to see me succeed. And, you know, he was obviously very distressed and very resistant to the police being all up in his business. But it was hard to deny what had happened in his house when they started looking in the bathroom and in the property drains. Because I told you that he had most likely done a lot of his work in the bathtub in that house. And as the police closed in, they found human flesh traces and tons of blood inside the drains of the tub. So as they started closing in and like really preparing to press the charges and arrest him, he again reaches out to his wife's sister. He wrote her a letter telling her, "I will travel to Edinburgh to see Isabella's other sister, Lizzie." And he wanted her to join them at Edinburgh and suggested that Isabella had been in touch with someone in Canada. Like, he was starting to confabulate all these stories about, "Oh, I heard Isabella's in Canada and the cops think I murdered her." And it's like, no, sir, she's not
Stop
in Canada.
It,
she's in the river.
Stop it, dude.
Yep. So he's really just trying to grasp at straws at this point. Mm-hmm. So he also complained that there's more bills that she's run up, and I'm getting bills from the dressmaker and all these gambling expenses and just making shit up to, which is so convenient when your wife is not here to defend herself, that you're just going to list all these wrongdoings that are made up, first of all, because she was just trying to exist and not get beat up by you on a daily basis, let's be honest. So he was telling her all of these things. He sent her this delusional letter. And Buck actually followed through on his statement that he was going to visit Isabella's sister, Lizzie, in October 1935. While investigators were still trying to seal that case against him, Buck met with Lizzie, and Jeannie ended up showing up too, like he had requested. Their encounter was very unpleasant for all parties. He was in this like highly excitable, like manic state, essentially. He was hysterical. He spoke about all these falsehoods and the gambling and the affairs and all of these things that he had sort of like confabulated in his own mind, or that we at least don't have any evidence of at all. And he talked without stopping for several hours.
So he's unraveling.
Like he is unhinged. Yep. Unhinged. So Buck mentions that Mary Rogerson was quote unquote in a state, like implying that she was pregnant and that she and Isabella had run off together to whatever take care of the situation. He rambled on about Isabella's debts, about living too extravagantly, about Mary's boyfriend and this pregnancy that was made up. And he just kept going and going and going, and how she had taken everything except the leather coat. He said, she had taken, you know, Isabella's hiding and she took everything from me except a leather coat. Which, okay, whatever. Dude. He also revealed that he had followed Isabella when she took a day trip to Scotland with Robert Edmondson and his family, and he was convinced they were having an affair. Remember all that?
Didn't happen.
He came up empty-handed, guys. But no matter what he did, He could not stop the cops from doing what they were doing. So he, on 9:30 p.m. on Saturday, October 12th of 1935, Dr. Buck Ruxton responded to a summons to the Lancaster Police Station. And there he was interviewed by the chief constable and several other officers, including some from Scotland also. And Buck denied that he had been in Scotland the week of September 15th and couldn't account for the fact that his car had hit a bicyclist while on his way there. I don't know who was driving my vehicle and hitting that man. He couldn't explain the number of bloodstains on the stairway. He couldn't explain the human flesh discovered in the drains of the house. There was a lot of just very mysterious, very murdery things.
I don't know.
That he just could
put that there?
Who put that there? I'm being framed. Right. The interview lasted like all night. He actually didn't return home until like 5 a.m. on Sunday morning, October 13th. And this actually worked to their advantage because the police re-entered his house to sort of sweep for fingerprints while Buck was being questioned. That was like their whole plan, like distract him, get him out of the house so we can like finish our investigation in peace. And so Lancaster Detective Lieutenant Hammond found fingerprints all over the house, particularly in the room where Mary Rogerson had stayed. And this confirmed that the younger corpse had been in the house, something that they hadn't been able to prove before. Like, they were actually not sure that Mary was murdered in the house along with Isabella, or if he went somewhere else to murder her.
Right.
But this evidence was pretty slam dunk for the case. Because it was a concrete nod.
I'm sure once they had DNA, they could be like, yeah, it was right here.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a concrete nod. It was like a concrete, this is Mary Rogerson. Like, mm-hmm. they were able to identify her based on that. And it's a well-known fact that all humans have a, you know, unique set of fingerprints. And they were the fact that they were able to isolate her fingerprint from the body parts that were found and match it to what was in her room. More incredible police work in 1935.
Right.
That's crazy. That's so great.
So, good job, guys.
Oh, did you know this? I found this while I was looking up this case, that even identical twins have different fingerprints.
I knew that.
I did not.
I knew that.
That's wild. You did? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I knew
so
that.
Anyway, I found that. I thought it was interesting. But in England in 1935, fingerprint identification was already
awesome
pretty
when
well established.
I know things that you don't.
You know a lot that I don't know.
Just
I'm not
saying.
Very smart.
Shut up.
Well, I'm not. I'm just being honest.
I'm going to punch you.
Okay. So, following the identification of Mary's fingerprints and all of the interviews they had and all the other physical evidence, at 7:20 a.m. on Sunday, October 18th, Buck Ruxton was arrested and charged with the murder of Mary Rogerson. They only charged with her murder because they were able to link her fingerprints directly to his property and match them to the corpse. So that's the only concrete one that they had. And because Isabella's body parts unfortunately contained no usable fingerprints, it took a little longer for investigators to determine that the second body was most likely her body.
Mm.
So on November 5th, he did end up being charged with her murder as well.
Here we go.
During the days of his hearing, between November 26th and December 13th of 1935, the townspeople crowded the outside of the hall. Like, this took the entire area by storm. It was a media frenzy. There were nearly 10,000 Lancaster residents that would eventually gather outside the town hall. And you know what? They were signing a petition on Buck's behalf.
What?
Yeah. There were 10,000 of those people that signed a petition on Buck's behalf for his release because he was such a prominent, because he took care of all of them.
Oh, please.
There were a ton of others, though. The crowd was very divided, that condemned the guy because they knew.
I mean, we see that.
Obviously,
we see that everywhere. People that just.
That's the thing. They don't
so
accept the facts.
Yeah,
exactly. They were all eager to hear what would happen to him, obviously. By mid-December, the trial date was set. And on Monday, March 2nd, 1936, Buck's trial opened at the Manchester Sisses. I think that's how you pronounce it. Over the course of 11 days, the prosecutors mounted a very impressive case. There were over 200 exhibits of evidence, from the letters to the articles of clothing to the newspapers with the dates and the serial numbers. They had photographs of the bodies. They had photographs of the larvae. They had expert testimonies from the entomologists and the dentists and everybody else who supported all of their evidence. They had testimonies from the housekeepers, the cleaning ladies, all the people that had witnessed things in the house, the abuse, the garbage men, police detectives that had witnessed Buck's erratic behavior during that first encounter. They had a very strong
case. They all had stuff to say.
But Buck had a lot of money and resources, and he didn't go down without a fight. His lawyers tried disproving the identification of the bodies as those of Isabella and Mary, and they contended the blood that was found on the suits, the carpets, the banisters, the stairs was all just the result of his surgical practice, and all the tissue in the drains was just him performing. I'm sorry, are you performing surgeries in your personal bedroom bathtub? I don't fucking think so. Give me a fucking break, bro.
That seems
bro.
Completely logical, Kate.
Like on your ensuite, you're Come just going to put someone in the fucking porcelain tub?
My gosh.
Like, well, shit. That's wild.
Missed revenue opportunities.
Mm-hmm. So Buck was very persistent, and he took the stand as the defense's only witness. And the examination of Buck took up the better part of 2 days, and it was often interrupted by his hysterics and theatrics and just manic rambling and shouting and just him being a general menace.
Nincompoop.
Nincompoop, if you will. Now, to this, his attorney, Norman Burkett, opened by asking Buck, what do you yourself say about your relationship with your wife in general over the last 5 years or so? And he replied, we could not live with each other and we could not live without each other, which is so chilling. Like, it gives me a chill to think about.
I think that's the definition of toxic.
Very much so.
I think it's the definition of toxic.
It definitely is. It definitely is. So it was just very harrowing, and the papers ate that up for sure. And Buck did not seem to mind that that level of vagueness that he was working with made him seem even guiltier. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you're basically acknowledging, you know, that you had a very toxic situation. Yeah. So the questions continued, and Buck sticks with the claim that Mary and Isabella had left together at 9 a.m. on Sunday, September 15th. And he blamed his housekeeper's testimony that his house smelled strangely on that Monday. His ripped up wallpaper was stinky.
It's because of the renovations,
Kate. It's because of the renovations.
The renovations.
He said that he told his patient, Mary Hampshire, to remove his name tag from the bloodstained clothing items that he had given to her, but that it was because he just didn't want them to get confused with her husband's. It's like, what do you mean? What do you mean?
Nope. What do you mean?
And then.
What do you mean?
Yeah.
Isn't there
and,
a meme with that?
Yeah.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
What do you mean? Yes, it's Jennifer.
Lawrence.
Jennifer Lawrence saying yes. that. Yeah. So these denials really didn't do much to overwhelm the other, like the prosecutor's case,
right.
You know. So on Friday, March 13th, 1936, Buck Ruxton was found guilty of the murder of his common-law wife and Mary Rogerson, and he was sentenced to death.
Ooh.
He was hanged at Strangeways Prison, which Strangeways Prison?
I mean, there are worse names.
That is a great name for
I know.
Damn. On a Tuesday morning in May. And according to some accounts, Ruxton's three children were brought up in an orphanage following the trial. And the area where Buck is believed to have drained the bodies of blood was removed by the Lancashire Constabulary Headquarters. So like the bathtub, they actually like took it out and, you know, removed it from the house.
That's good.
And they pretty much the house to Dalton Square, they gutted the entire thing.
It got renovated.
It did. Yeah.
No pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. The tub, apparently, they started using as a water trough for the police horses.
Ew.
Which seems a little like there's nothing else you could have
like
could've
an actual
used.
Trough?
Like, you guys literally didn't have any resources. You couldn't buy,
I mean,
like,
they were
a bucket?
Fully in belief of recycling.
Yeah, I mean, that's hardcore recycling.
Yeah.
Damn. So Garden Home Linnestream, which is where they found that initial dump site, is now known to locals as Ruxton's Dump. That's what it's
called. I'm looking for it when I go to Scotland.
Okay, there you go.
Buxton's Dump.
Like I said, they did renovate 2 Dalton Square. It did remain vacant for 2 decades after the murders. Up until the 1980s when it was acquired then by the Lancaster City Council for offices. So then after it had been renovated, they all moved in. But it's pretty crazy to think about the outcomes of this, like from a scientific, medical, forensic
standpoint. You know, like... For you did the job with what you had, and you it damn good.
Hell yeah, you did. And this was groundbreaking. The use of forensic entomology, for example, with the blowfly larvae, that was unprecedented. That has never been before used to help solve a crime ever. The stuff with the skull photography, the skull work, the dental stuff, like everything, the piece by piece body reconstruction. And just the looking at the papers, the police work is so exceptional in this case.
Yeah.
And
90 years later, and sometimes there's cases where they still screw it up.
Yes, exactly. It was such a huge advancement in corpse and crime scene identification. Mm-hmm. And these killings led to a much greater reliance on forensic science as a whole. And it actually helped cement the validity of forensics in criminal investigations.
And like the advancement of it.
And the advancement of forensics as its own science, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, for sure.
So to this day, people from Scotland and England both remember his murder and the trial. And there's actually a song that came out of this, or like a weird poem of some kind. And this is how it goes. Are you ready?
I don't know.
I don't know either. red stains on the carpet, red stains on the knife. Oh, Dr. Buck Ruxton, you murdered your wife. Then Mary, she saw you. You thought she would tell. So, Dr. Buck Ruxton, you killed her as well.
Call it a day. That reminds me of the Lizzie Borden one.
I was going to say it reminded me of Michael Jackson, the blood stains on the carpet.
I mean, that too. Maybe that's
it. Annie, are you okay?
What?
Annie, are you okay?
Are you okay?
Are you okay, Annie?
I'm not okay.
I know you're not okay.
I'm not okay.
Oh, here we go. That's Jelly Roll. That's just Jelly Roll.
Yeah. Well, doozy.
Bam.
Satisfying ending.
Chow!
Satisfying ending.
Yep.
Thank you for listening, everyone. If you want to continue listening to us, you can check us out on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast.
You can find us on YouTube by searching Med Crimes Podcast.
You can follow us on Instagram at Med Crimes Podcast.
If you want to become a Patreon, you can find us at www.patreon.com/MedCrimesPodcast.
If you want to send us any crazy stories, ideas, suggestions, which, believe it or not, we're almost to August, which means we are rounding the corner.
That's wild.
We are rounding the corner more than halfway over of season 5. Going to start prepping for a break room banter in a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
You can check us out at medcrimes@gmail.com.
Stay safe out there, bitches.
Toodaloo.